You are listening to the Riverfront Church Podcast, a place to explore faith, history, ideas, and more.
So I am Pastor Emma, and tonight at Think and Drink, we are talking about the book of Luke. And what we are going to start with is about the last 10 minutes or so about the best Christmas pageant ever, which are y'all familiar with that?
No.
No.
I got nothing.
Really? Okay, so backstory. I went to a Christian elementary school, and they were a little bit crazy, but that's a whole other story. Anyway, they really like to show us this movie, and this movie is about this family that is part of this pageant that this teacher really wants to put on, and no one thinks that they're going to do a good job. Everybody thinks they're going to mess it up because they're a family from kind of the wrong side of the tracks, and they don't behave in that perfect little Christian package or whatever. And so there was all this anxiety about what's going to happen during the Christmas pageant. They have some really, really important roles. And so we're going to watch the last 10 minutes or so of this, and I'm going to tell you why we're going to get back to how it connects back to Luke after we watch it. So, but what I want y'all to watch for are the things that jump out for you. What details stand out? What do you notice? What do you see or not see? And yeah, that's it. So hopefully it's loud enough and hopefully you can see it. If not, I can reach closer.
So for the podcast audience, we just enjoyed that YouTube clip, and if you want to check it out yourselves, what was the name of the...
It's called The Best Christmas Pageant Ever. It's the 1983 version. There is the full movie on YouTube, which is probably illegal, but whatever. If you want to know what we just watched, it's on YouTube.
And it was just the last 10 minutes of,
so.
the...
Yeah. It's basically when they're actually performing the pageant, if you're familiar with the story, podcasty land. So, yes. Y'all, what did you see?
So, the birth of Christ.
Okay.
The wise men, the shepherds, the ham.
The angel who was late.
Okay.
And rushed everybody to see Jesus.
So, only because I've been thinking about, you know, as we're studying each of these four Gospels individually and knowing that that whole story is actually a combination of what we find in Matthew and what we find in Luke. So, it's not a single source material.
But a lot of the text that the narrator was reading is almost straight out of the book of Luke, and then a little bit more, too. A lot of times when you hear the Christmas passage read out of on Christmas Eve, a lot of times they'll lean towards a lot of the Luke passage because it's a pretty complete telling of the story. And they might mash in a little bit more because you want to get the wise man and everybody there at one time.
Right,
and
right.
The story doesn't happen as neat and cleanly. What else did you see in that scene? Like, as a movie, not just like the birth of Christ part.
Well, as a movie, there was a little comedy in it.
Okay.
There was a little comedy. Like, I guess sometimes it's like that reverence, mm-hmm. but we forget the laugh. And then the one kid came up with the ham, and nobody really, like, laughed at it. They just kept going.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no matter what happened, they just kept going. Like, when the angel was late, they just kept going.
Mm-hmm.
And they just kept doing their parts, and people just showed up when they got there.
So, and what I saw was the kind of familiarity I think most audiences have around the Christmas time. You know, and same could be said for Easter, if you're watching a passion play sort of production. It's like, you know what's happening. You know, there's no... No suspense or drama
mm-hmm.
from the script, you know, just mm-hmm. because you're so familiar with it. The only suspense or drama in this case is whether or not these particular young actors are going to pull it off. You know,
mm-hmm.
are they going to hit their marks? Are they going to, you know, actually show up on time or whatever? And then you see liberties being taken by those young actors that I think it almost jars someone into... The little boy playing that angel, like, bringing a sense of excitement that I don't think I've ever seen in any other production, you know, of like, guys, yeah, this is it. Let's go. Let's go.
He's like hitting them in the butt.
This is a big deal. Yeah.
Yeah, he was like literally a shepherd.
Yeah.
The one thing that I did notice, there was a character in the audience. Well, the audience started actually participating in the play mm-hmm. by singing. And one of the characters, she started to cry.
Mm-hmm.
And then, in the audience, and then you saw the actor that was playing Mary, she kind of had that tearing up look.
Mm-hmm.
And then, what's her name? From MASH, I forget her name, but she was on the sidelines. And mm-hmm. she was kind of like the teacher or director, and she started tearing up a little bit. So as people, like, actually, even though they heard the story a lot of times before, they started becoming emotionally attached to the whole thing. Like, I don't know. Like, it was almost like they knew it was the end of the play, and they were so happy that they finally got to this point,
mm-hmm.
the arrival. And it was like, a lot of times I don't think Christmas and crying, right?
Mm-hmm.
Christmas is happy, 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 wee, wee, wee. And to see that emotion in the Christmas play was kind of like, that was something a little different.
One of the things that I noticed when I watched this is who the camera lingered on. And I didn't really give y'all the full context of who all the characters were, sort of on purpose to see if y'all would see the same thing that I did. And a lot of the characters that the camera really intentionally lingered on, not the narrator, not the ones that were kind of the natural focus, were the children who would have been otherwise not part of the story, that normally would not have been part of that pageant for whatever reason. So the person who played Mary, the person who played that angel, basically all the people that they had to kind of hunt for, and then they lingered on them, those are the children that are the main characters of this Best Christmas Pageant Ever, that are considered not worthy of being part of the story, but they're focused on. And so when I was thinking about the Book of Luke, I was trying to think of some kind of really powerful Alan worthy visual, and that was the thing that hit me, because I don't know why. And that's one of the things that I really love about Luke, is that the stories that are lifted up in the Book of Luke are about the people who are poor or poor in spirit, or society is considered less than, or less important, or things like that, that normally wouldn't get lifted up in stories. And I thought that was just such a beautiful visual in this familiar story to see characters and people lingered on that wouldn't normally be on there. So I'm curious, what do y'all know about the Book of Luke?
He was a doctor.
Yes.
He was a Greek citizen.
Mm-hmm.
Was he Jewish? I'm not sure.
What do y'all think? Poll the audience.
I don't think he was Jewish.
What do you think, Ken? Master of Smartness. Edit that part out.
I don't believe he was writing for a Jewish audience.
Okay. So there's kind of some disagreements about the actual author of the Book of Luke, but it is commonly believed that he was a doctor. A lot of people do believe that he was a Gentile, so he was not Jewish. Most scholars believe that he is not giving an eyewitness account. It's not him that saw these things. It's him that heard these stories and is telling them in a different way. So last week we explored the Book of Mark. Yes, Mark. And the kind of example that Ken shared was that guy at the beginning of Ant-Man that's like, you know, the one that like tells the story, is a really funny guy.
Right.
This is basically the opposite of that. This is that friend that comes in after that that's like, okay, you heard that version. Now, let me slow it down for you for a second. I don't think he told you the whole story. So if we're looking at Luke compared to Mark, Mark is kind of that, and suddenly, and immediately, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And Luke is like, okay, I'm going to take my time. I'm going to tell the story correctly. And I identify so much with Luke in like, so many ways.
Now, it's also interesting that Luke, it's Luke and Acts.
Mm-hmm, yes.
So, there's something about the way that the Bible was arranged when canonized, that it's like, oh my gosh, if only they had arranged the Gospels so that, it was Luke, Acts, so that you have that flow you know, rather than
Axe also?
Well, correct. Yes. And I'll show you how you can, one of the hints. Will somebody look up for me Axe 1 on your handy dandy pocket computer? So let's hear the first verse of Luke while we're talking about that. Since many have undertaken to set down an orderly account of the events that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed on to us by those who were from the beginning were eyewitnesses and service of the world. I too decided, after investigating everything carefully from the very first, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the truth concerning the things which you have been instructed. And now, Acts 1. Who has it? Go ahead.
In my former book, Theophilus, I wrote about all that Jesus began to do and to teach until the day he was taken up to heaven.
You can stop there. And what are the similarities?
Writing to the same person.
Uh-huh.
Referencing the same material.
Yes.
Yes.
In my first book.
Yes. Yeah. And, yeah, it is such a shame that Luke and Acts aren't back to back, because it's literally, and here's the end of one story, and here we're picking up at the next story.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so the common belief is that it was one author, Gentile doctor, kind of trying to be very orderly, some kind of physician-y sort of person.
And you actually see certain themes develop. There is a comparison between the way that he portrays Paul to the way he portrays Jesus. There's, you know, it's sort of like, hey, there's a mirroring here that people should pay attention to.
That's exciting.
Well, looking at it, for me, it looks like when they put it together,
mm-hmm.
you got Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, all telling the same story in their own way, which kind of drives home that story. And then Acts.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which goes on into more of a, like, a ministry kind of
it just book. It would have been nice to have, like, Matthew, Mark, John, Luke, then Acts.
Mm-hmm. Like, put it last.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things that I have over there in my bag that I bring over is it has the gospel parallels and the stories lined up, and so you can see what is in one and what is not in the other. And oh. so I could show that to you. Also, it's on the internet, so podcast friends, look it up on the internet. But there are these stories that are paralleled, but there's also things that are unique to each one of them. one of the things that makes the book of Luke unique is a couple things. First, is that Luke gives really preferential treatment to those, like I said earlier, that are poor, that are underprivileged, that are considered less than in society. Luke also does a lot of work with prayer and worship, and also spends some time talking about possessions and how we're to treat possessions and what kind of life we are to live. Similar to other Gospels, we have a lot of story overlap. So some of the stories that we'll talk about today, we talked about last week with Mark, and then we'll talk about them again. And we'll probably talk about them again because they just keep coming up, that they're very important. But the thing about Luke that is interesting to me is the way and order in which he tells things. And it's different than the order that some of the other Gospels tell things. Not chronological order, but just the way that he tells the stories. So the first time that I really noticed that, we're looking at chapter 1. And the very first thing we get is about John the Baptist and Jesus. And we get some background story about each one of them. And unlike other Gospels, we don't start with a genealogy. We don't start with in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was God, and the Word was with God. It is really digging into the story of John the Baptist. And it's not him all of a sudden, ta-da, grown up. We learn a lot about his family and really get that social setting so that we see how John the Baptist and then eventually Jesus are sort of the societal outcast in some ways. Like, the position that they were born into, we have to know that to understand the rest of the stories. And we keep going, John the Baptist, Jesus, and we don't actually get the genealogy until flip the page, until much, much, much later, after the story that we heard in the Best Christmas Pageant Ever, the birth story, the growing up of Jesus, And then we don't get the genealogy until a lot later, until they're adults. And I'm wondering, why do you think that is? Why didn't we start with genealogy for Luke? If knowing people's social positions and knowing that Luke has preferential treatment for the outcast, why might we start with stories and not with genealogy?
Because it's unimportant to the reader.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the book of Luke was more written to, like you said, like more to the Gentiles, more to the people who didn't really understand or grow up in the Jewish culture. So he's just trying to, you know, tell people like, hey, let me tell you about Jesus and this and that. And maybe once you got to know the characters, then he thought it was important for you to know that, hey, these two are related mm-hmm. and there's significance to it. But it wasn't important in the beginning of the story.
Because he's telling the story of Jesus and not the story of Jesus' lineage.
Mm-hmm.
Because the other stories were... The lineage was in there to show that he was the person that's prophesied
mm-hmm.
in the scripture.
Okay.
But to somebody that's not Jewish, they don't know the scripture and they don't really care. So there's no real buy-in. They're more interested in who was this person, Jesus, that was around,
mm-hmm.
and tell me about him,
mm-hmm.
you know? And then it's kind of like a flashback sequence. Like, it's like, oh, okay, so I told you what this guy did. Now let me tell you about his story, like mm-hmm. how he came to be where he is, you know? So I think it was more for the reader, because this definitely is, all the other ones don't talk about the writing of the word.
Mm-hmm.
So you think it's, I think I always think of it as being more auditory. Like they were telling the story to another person.
Mm-hmm.
And this actually, like when you had us read that one part and it talks about writing,
mm-hmm.
it literally says writing, which meant he was educated to write it down, which meant this was something that was tangible.
Mm-hmm.
Like this was the story that it's not relying upon me just telling you it. It's like, here, you want to know about him? Here you go.
Yeah.
And I hand it to you, and you go off with it. So.
And we actually don't get the genealogy until chapter 3, verse 23. And it starts, verse 23 starts, Jesus was about 30 years old when he began his work. He was the son of, as was thought, of Joseph, son of all the way down, to verse 38. Son of Enos, son of Seth, son of Adam, son of God. But we don't get that until we have Jesus as an adult. And the way that I understand this is, think about how you might introduce yourself to someone. So I need somebody who would be willing to go, who would like to introduce themselves. Okay, go ahead. If I was a random person and you didn't know me, how would you introduce yourself?
Okay, hi, my name is Damon.
Okay, a little bit more information than that.
Okay, I like to take pictures.
Okay.
I like gadgets.
Okay.
And I don't know, sunsets, I don't know.
Okay, yeah, it doesn't matter, you could literally lie, I wouldn't know the difference. Yeah. So, when you are identifying yourself, you're not, I am Damon, son of blah, 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 because that's not the story that would help people to really know who you are in your actions, in your emotions, in your feelings, in the ways that you are. It might help people know where your bloodline came from, which to some people that's very important. But we're not talking deep South Southern Jesus here who needs to know who everybody's family is.
Right.
It's more Jesus of the story, of buying into the story, of being part of that story of Mary, of Joseph, of John the Baptist. And that part of it is way more important to Luke than tracing it all the way back. But in putting this in there as Jesus as an adult, it's almost saying, oh yeah, y'all that are going to try to discredit him a little bit later, I'm going to throw this little bit of genealogy in there because it's important.
Right.
It's just not the most important thing. So if we keep going in the book of Luke, starting in chapter 4, chapters 4 through 8 are all about the poor. And not necessarily the poor, like monetary poor, but the poor and the underprivileged in society. And the people that society seems to view as undervalued. Excuse me. But before we really, really get into the healings, we look at chapter 4, verse 31. And this is a familiar passage to me, and maybe to some other people as well. And that is the story when Jesus is going out, and he will get recognized by a demon, by people. The demons kind of call him by his name, and this happens over and over again. They know who Jesus is, and other people don't. They don't recognize him. What do y'all make of that?
So there's a couple of interesting theories. The first is that we're implying that, yeah, there's another worldliness aspect to the story. Another is that this idea that knowing someone's name gives you power over them.
The whole Voldemort sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And that these demons are sort of like, oh, we know who you are, Jesus. You know, that's a theory that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Names weren't very powerful because you weren't supposed to say the name of God.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're demons, then for me it seems like demons are like the workers of the devil.
Okay.
So Jesus tempted by the devil for 40 days, and he's probably frustrating the devil. So the devil's going back to his minions and saying, "Hey, there's this guy Jesus. He's the real deal. Holyfield, you got to break him."
So we read in verse 31, and this is chapter 4, Jesus went down to Capernaum, a city in Galilee, and was teaching them on the Sabbath. They were astounded at his teaching because he spoke with authority. And in the synagogue there was a man who had the spirit of an unclean demon and cried out in a loud voice, "Leave us alone. What would you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth?" So they're not just like, oh, holy person. They are calling him out by his name.
Use his government name.
Yeah, use his full name. But Jesus rebuked him and said, "Be silent and come out of him." And when the demon had thrown him down before him, he came out of him without having done him any harm. They, the people around, were all amazed and kept saying to one another, "What kind of utterance is this? For with authority and power he commands the unclean spirits, and out they come." And report about him began to reach every place in the region. So imagine if you are one of those early... sorry, I'm about to lose my voice. I'm trying to get real powerful. imagine you are one of those early people that are starting to hear some whispers that there might be someone doing healings. Now, these are stories you would have probably heard before. This is not a completely unknown concept. But there might be something different about this person. How might you have felt? What might you have done if, not assuming you're one of the disciples, because that's really easy. We say, oh yeah, we love Jesus. Yay, Jesus. But assuming that you're someone who hasn't made up their mind, how might you have reacted if you saw that story or if you heard that story?
Good piece of entertainment.
Okay.
Circus is in town.
Some hope.
It all depends on which station it is. Like, if everything's going fine, then it's kind of like existing. Like, to me, it would just be like the entertainment, you know. Because I don't know. Unless you're suffering, you really don't want. I mean, to me, it's not like follow somebody unless you're suffering, kind of thing.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's not like his disciples were actually suffering at the point where Jesus came across them. They just followed him for some, because he said to follow him. But if anybody else started whispering, they probably were like, you know, you hear about something awesome, you're like, yo, did you catch that show last night? It was, you know, and that's how the stuff, you know, the women are down washing the clothes, and they're like, did you hear? Did you hear? Did you hear? Oh my goodness, really? You know, so I think that's what it was.
So who might have thought that this sort of healing was not good news? What sort of people would have been disturbed or disrupted by it?
The powerful and the comfortable.
Yeah, I think the Pharisees and the people who have had that authority, and now this guy's coming along, and like it says... with authority and power, he gives orders to impure spirits, and also the fact that when he did it, no harm came to the man. Mm-hmm. Like, when he cast this demon out, like, everybody saw it, and everybody saw this man was possessed, and now he's not possessed. The demon's out of him, but he wasn't harmed. So they're like, wow, he's on a different level. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like, you're taking away some of my authority and my power, and now what am I going to do if you come along and become the Almighty that you're supposed to be, but we don't really want to believe you're him, but maybe you are him. Mm. You know, probably would have caused them to worry, yeah. You know, the Pharisees. And then the people who didn't know and saw it were like, what? Mm-hmm. Maybe this is Jesus. And for the demon, because the demon actually calls him out by name.
Right.
So the demon's saying, oh, I'm scared because you have come to take me out because I know you are the Son of God and I'm afraid. Mm-hmm. So for the demon to say in front of all these people that he was afraid of this Jesus guy, everybody in the crowd who saw could be like, oh my God, he really is who he says he is. So there's a lot in that little verse.
Mm-hmm.
And you also think about if the guy was possessed by an unclean spirit, the only way at that time to become clean is a sacrifice. Mm. And in order to get a sacrifice, you had to spend money.
Mm.
So if there's no sacrifice, there's no money changing hands, and there's nobody making a profit off of the demon possession business.
Mm-hmm.
So he just undercut a whole lot of people.
Mm.
He just went in a lot of people's pockets.
Yeah, sort of on a side note, not related to the economics of it, but that is a different perspective thinking about this. Is I was actually listening to a podcast earlier today, and it was about speaking in tongues and faith healing. And that was the part of the book of Luke and some of the other scriptures that I get stuck on and that I have a hard time with. Like, I 100% believe that Jesus has the power to do that sort of work, but my intellectual mind gets hung up on it and like, okay, but what, but how, but, you know, my faithful heart can say, of course, yeah, it's Jesus. Jesus does all these things, but I get stuck on it. And so sometimes getting stuck in that intellectual part of my mind means that I can't get past the story to see the overarching sort of narrative of Jesus was a healer for people in a way that wasn't societally acceptable in a lot of different ways. And I'm wondering if anyone has ever kind of wrestled with that or struggled with it, if it's just me. I know it's sort of an aside, but it's sort of also related.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
You always want to know why, you know, or how,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Well, and there is, you know, as we've discussed in previous weeks, you know, is the writer trying to say something else when they're talking about healing blind people and yet other people being blind to what's happening in front of them? You know, is that more of a literary device,
mm-hmm.
rather than a literal, you know, some of these, if they're saying demon possession, sounds to me like a form of epilepsy possibly,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, other parts of the Bible where, yeah, you talk about going back to, you know, Saul and being cursed with it. You know, it's like, well, that sounds like possibly depression. Possibly, you know, there's things that we look at now, and I'm like, I think we can maybe see a modern connotation, mm-hmm. to these things. So it's that's not to take away from the possibility for the miraculous. Just I'm like you. I get hung up if someone demands an absolute literal interpretation of it.
Yeah,
but I could be wrong.
Yeah, and this in the book of Luke, especially, there are so many of these different healings that happen that are just like a word, a whatever. There's not even so much of that physicality that we saw some in the book of Mark and some other gospels where Jesus does a thing and then a thing happens, like does a physical thing. These are more words that Jesus is saying or doing. And so to me, I got a little stuck on that, and then I was like, oh no, we got to see the bigger picture. And it is important to see the bigger picture so that we can kind of see that God is bigger than those things we get hung up on. I guess that was my roundabout way to come back to that.
The taking up, the story of when Jesus is taken up,
mm-hmm.
That's the one that blew the doors out. Like when
okay.
When they completely, because for me, when I was like younger, it was like, okay, Jesus is born Christmas, mm-hmm. and then Jesus dies Easter, and then some stuff happens, and then the story kind of fades away, right? And then it's Revelation, right? The world's going to end. And then I was introduced to, you know, the part where Jesus is taken up. And it was like, what do you mean he was taken up? Like he went back to death, and they're like, no, he was taken up. Like, he just, and I'm like, so you mean to tell me that he's still alive around? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, but wait. Mm-hmm. And that took me, like, that really propelled me back into it, because it was the whole fact that I had always looked at it as a beginning and an end for everything. And then that part is when Jesus became eternal, you know, became like beyond this physical thing. Like, the miracles. Yeah, okay, yeah, I can do that. Yeah, yeah, he touched somebody. Okay, yeah, you can see. Oh, yeah, that's cool. But it was when he was taken up and then the Holy Spirit comes back down. And it's like, what? Wait a minute. And they showed me in different scripture how other people had been taken up, but not in the same way. And then the transfiguration mm-hmm. that happens,
yeah.
when that happens, it's like he gets a glow and there's other people standing there with him to differentiate who Jesus was and who these other people were, or who Jesus is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was always a point that Jesus is now. Like, it wasn't just like whenever referring to Jesus as a past. It's not a past,
mm-hmm.
and it's not a Jesus will. It's Jesus is,
mm-hmm.
like, and you know, and he refers to himself. So that was one of the things I did go through that, and it was like he was taken up,
yeah.
like an elevator, like, you know, like take me, beat me up, Scotty, kind of thing. It was like I didn't get it, and I wrestled with it. So I definitely felt that where the analytical reasoning and the actual faith and just like, okay, he was taken up. Like, all right, yeah, sure, I can accept that. That was something that was, that kind of hit me.
Uh-huh.
And was, caught me off guard. So, but that was a perfect expression. Like, I thought I knew about it until I actually had to take that from my head and put it into my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of like breathe it.
Well, and if you're, for those of y'all who may not have the whole scripture memorized, looking at the book of Luke, we have those two stories that happen in there. Spoiler alert, y'all. But if we fast forward right to the end of Luke, we do get that story of Jesus ascending to heaven, as we talk about in some of the creeds and confessions. Verse 50 says, then he, who's Jesus, led them out as far as Bethany, and lifting up his hands, he blessed them. And while he was blessing them, he withdrew from them and was carried up into heaven. And they worshipped him and returned to Jerusalem with great joy. And they were continually in the temple blessing God. And as I was reading that, I was doing big liturgical hands, because you kind of can't help it. You're like, da-da, Jesus.
Right now, Pastor Emma has her hand in the air.
Yeah.
Open form, arms up.
So it is that miraculous sort of story. And there's something about ending a book on this story that doesn't make any sense in our logical mind, like, you know, the beam me up Jesus, okay, now what?
Yeah, yeah.
And then we get to the book, if you're following along in your Bible sort of as it's laid out, we go back to the beginning of the story in John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was God.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're reading your Bible straight through, or you're just reading the next paragraph, you get that grounding. You get to say, wow, there was this incredible thing that's mind-blowing that, like, alters the way that we think about Jesus' humanity. And then, if you go straight to John, you're grounded again to say, we're back to the beginning of the story, and we're not just back to the beginning of any story, but the story that the Word and God and everything is all tied in together in this miraculous and messy, but also really wonderful way. So it's like that up and down sort of thing. And then we also have the ascension, or excuse me, the transfiguration in the book of Luke. And it's in Luke 9, which is almost the halfway point of the book of Luke. And there are some people, when they're talking about that story, they say this is where things change. Like, a lot. So if you're reading along, you're like, cool, cool, Jesus healing, whatever, calling some disciples, what's up? Ta-da, shiny Jesus. Like, sort of a mind-blowing moment.
Jesus.
Yes. Now, about 8 days after these sayings, Jesus took with him Peter and John and James and went up on the mountain to pray, which I'm, okay, this is not in the Bible. I'm not reading a weird version. But I'm imagining they probably did that a lot, praying together, going up together.
Yeah. It depends on the gospel. I mean, Mark, outside of that one, I'm not even sure if, no, the transfiguration, it's simply the transfiguration, it's not. Mark, Jesus is always praying by himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And never actually, with anybody else. But then other Gospels, they have them, you know.
And I kind of think I also gravitate towards Luke, because there's also introvert Jesus in the Bible, in the book of Luke, because he does go off by himself a lot, and he reflects, and he does these things. So could also be why I like it. Back to story. Whoa. Back to story, though. And while he was praying, the appearance of his face changed and his clothes became dazzling white. And suddenly they saw two men, Moses and Elijah, talking to him. They appeared in glory and were speaking of his departure, which he was about to accomplish in Jerusalem. Now Peter and his companions were weighed down with sleep, but since they had stayed awake, they saw his glory and two men stood with him. And then the story keeps going. But you were just talking about how that's one of those stories that's like, what?
Yeah.
Cool with the other stuff, but oh my gosh, what just happened?
Because nobody's done that in the whole, all the books. Like, there have been other miracles, but nobody has changed in such a, except for like Moses. Like, Moses comes down and they said that he looked like he had been with God or something like that.
Mm-hmm. He got so shiny he had to put the veil on.
Yeah.
The ultimate highlighter. Right. That was how I talked about it the other week.
He's like, I need a filter.
cover it. But it is that point where the disciples really, 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 in case they weren't paying attention before, and I don't know how they would have missed it, this is something different. Jesus is doing something different. It's saying something different. It's warning them about what to come, which had happened before. But this is a very visible and real sign. And it's one of those moments that when we're reading through the scriptures, it's all too easy, like we saw in the movie, to get really comfortable with the story.
Mm.
Like, okay, and then now this baby Jesus, and now grown up Jesus, la la la, Easter! Yeah, but that thing you just did with your hands, the shifty, changey, stop, pay attention.
Right.
Do these things that help us to focus on the story and not get so distracted or not get so complacent. And that's one of the places where we can really stop and then pay attention again. So we keep going in the book of Luke, and we are fast forwarding to chapter 10. And in chapter 10, when we start looking at verses 38 to 42, we get a story that, while there's little snippets and things of it in other, so the Gospels, this story in its entirety is mostly in the book of Luke. Is there someone who would like to read Luke chapter 10, verses 38 through
42?
38
to 42?
Mm-hmm.
I'll take it.
Okay.
As they were traveling along, Jesus went into a village. A woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. She had a sister named Mary. Mary sat at the Lord's feet and listened to him talk. But Martha was upset about all the work she had to do. So she asked, "Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work all by myself? Tell her to help me." The Lord answered her, "Martha, Martha, you worry and fuss about a lot of things. There's only one thing you need. Mary has made the right choice, and that one thing will not be taken away from her."
So what did we hear?
Something tells me Mary and Martha had a kind of a tense childhood, too.
I can see that. Yep.
Yeah. This probably wasn't the first time that these two sisters didn't quite see eye to eye on something.
Didn't want to share headpieces one day. I'm not wearing your blue headpiece. You have to wear it. I'm wearing my green one.
Did you have a sister growing up?
too.
Oh, okay.
And I think this is, you know, Jesus was just simply trying to say, I'm here to teach and to share with you. And you're so worried about, you know, making a meal or making sure the wine was right that you totally missed the purpose of why I'm here. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes Damon always tells me this, he's like, you've got to stop and be in the moment. And I think this is one of those stories that shares that exactly. Like, you totally missed the moment. Like, you were doing this and doing that, and you were busy with all these preparations, and you didn't hear a word I said. You didn't enjoy the visit. You didn't get to spend any time with me, you know. And Jesus knew he was soon to be leaving. They didn't. But, you know, like he said, your sister chose the right thing, and that won't be taken away. So she got all that knowledge and that time with Jesus.
But this is also breaking a lot of cultural norms. Mm-hmm. It was not a woman's place to sit and listen, engage in teaching. The woman's place was to, Martha was fulfilling the traditional role. So kind of what I think she's asking is, not only is there some kind of, like, I'm sure, decades-old sisterly quarrel happening on the subtext, but also, hey, she's, you know, she's not supposed to be here. She's not supposed to be here doing that. Mm. You know, she's supposed to culturally, this is where she's supposed to be, is helping me serve the food.
But there's another part that I read in there, and it says, as they were traveling, Jesus went to a village. A woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. So Martha's welcoming him in, and then the sister Mary is the one that's sitting at the feet, which is kind of like, but wait, he's my Jesus. Yeah. Like, he should be like, I welcome him in, and now all of a sudden you're hanging with him, but he should be, you know, and it almost feels like there's jealousy there. Mm-hmm. It almost feels like she's like, because she's already breaking norm by inviting a male into the house. Mm-hmm. So she just invited this male into the house because he's Jesus. He's Jesus, the rock star, the superstar, right? He's known. And then the sister is sitting by the feet, and she's like, oh, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. Almost like the prodigal son's brother. Mm-hmm. Like, I've always been there with you, but, you know, you never wanted to have a party. And then you celebrate with Mary, right? Mm. So that's what it seems to me. It seems like there's a jealousy there. Like, I invite this person. Like, I never had any brothers or sisters, but I would see this happen. Like, I would go over somebody's house, and I would play with the person that didn't invite me over the house, and they would get upset because I was supposed to be their play buddy or whatever. And they'd be like, oh, mom said you got to do the dishes, ha-ha, you know, and it's like, and it just got really weird, and I'm like, yeah, awkward. I think I just want to, like, leave. And Jesus says, you know, I'm here. Mm-hmm. She made the choice. You can't take that from her or take me from her just because of the law, right? Because of the norm. Mm-hmm. Like, so that's what I kind of got, the jealousy.
Well, and what I was thinking about as we were just talking is that, and lifting up these two women, among many other people that are lifted up in this book, it's really emphasizing how complicated all of us are, because it's not like clear 100% doing the right Mary, 100% doing the wrong Martha, or vice versa. It's a really messy sort of story. And reading this, like, you know, when you lifted up the part where Martha welcomed him, like, I had never focused on that phrase before, but that's what you would do. You would provide hospitality. It's like, you know, an honor and everything. Mm. And it's, she's not being shamed for doing that. It's like her getting distracted and not paying attention to Jesus. But she did this thing that was really good first. So it's that really complicated. How do you live into faith? You know, even if you consider yourself, and we probably all do in one way or the other at some time in our life, that voice that is not part of the societal perfect little box of whatever, how can you live into loving God and being who God created you to be, knowing that it's going to be that messy sort of thing, and sometimes you'll get it right, and sometimes you'll get it wrong. It's kind of a challenge that I'm hearing in this text today. I might hear a different thing tomorrow. Tomorrow I might want to just not clean my house, and I'll be like, oh, I'll do the right thing. Jesus wouldn't want me to. If I read my Bible, I don't have to clean my house. You know? No, still clean your house.
There is a whole lot in there. It's a short passage, but there is a lot of wild choices in there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot. Because who's right and who's wrong, there really isn't. And Jesus is not saying anybody's right or wrong. He's just saying that, you know, we make choices. Once you make a choice, that's pretty much, you know.
So, strikes again. So we're going to keep going in Luke because we've got some more Luke. We just passed the midway point, so we may or may not get through all of it. But as we keep going, we get to chapter 11 and we hear about the Lord's Prayer, or at least parts of it that many people are familiar with and say in the community that they worship with. We hear the ask, seek, and knock. That is a very familiar sort of story. And then we keep going and we get all these little tiny pieces and parts that you might hear the little snippets of. Part of it in chapter 11, verse 33, no one after lighting a lamp puts it into a cellar, but on the lampstand so that those who enter it may see the light. If your eye is a lamp of your body, if your eye is healthy, your whole body is full of light. And then it keeps going. And it keeps talking about lights and rays of light and how we, like, live into that. But there's more to the story than that. It's not just Jesus saying all these really nice and lovely things. There's also a lot of hate that's happening. A lot of kind of that backstabbing. A lot of that, well, look what he's doing. Look at who he's talking to. Kind of reminds me of, like, being a middle school girl. And you're like, oh, yeah, that's cute. And then not being very nice behind your back. Did you see, you know, the face, the middle school girl face? And that, to me, is almost the way that the Pharisees are acting towards him. They're like, I mean, you're fine, but not really. And then going behind his back and working to betray him, to undermine him, to catch him in the things that he is not doing right. And he kind of calls him out on it, too. He says to his disciples in chapter 12, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees. That is their hypocrisy. Nothing is covered up that will not be uncovered, and nothing that is secret will not become known. Therefore, whatever you have said in the dark will be heard in the light, and whatever you have whispered behind closed doors will be proclaimed from the housetops. So Jesus knows. Jesus knows those things that are being said about him, not just that he will have to die and take on the sins of the world, not just the ultimate big story, but that there's also these, like, gossipy, trying to catch you in doing the bad thing, religious leaders, this hypocrisy of them trying to do right so hard that they're getting it way super wrong.
But arguably, Jesus is also there. I'm going to say he's the first advocate for actual transparency.
Okay, say more.
That you know, these days you see this, whether it's in the political world or the business world, you know, that transparency is key. You know, you kind of want people to see you for who you really are, you know, and to, you know, in the restaurant scene, you know, you went from this idea of the kitchen being in a whole separate room, and nobody got kitchens back there. Mm-hmm. To now, it's an open kitchen. We, you know,
my office is,
you know, it's
a,
yeah,
it's an open floor.
Yeah,
200 people on an open floor. It is interesting.
Yeah, but it's this whole idea, the idea of transparency is the you know, the political candidate. I'll just defer back to that. Is who says, you know, I'm not going to wait until the government requires me to reveal who my donors are. I'm just going to put it out there.
Mm-hmm.
Be transparent. Yeah. You know, here it is. There are no secrets. I'm going to, you know, it's all out there, as opposed to those that, you know, if you're engaged in, you know, questionable activity, it eventually most of the time will come to light.
Mm-hmm. One way or the other.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Jesus is definitely advocating for transparency, for kind of calling into light the things that are happening. And seeing people as they are, which is in Luke, because we get that theme over and over again about him being with and talking with and sharing in the stories of people who society says aren't good enough. It is seeing past those things that society kind of would block people off with, whether it was their gender, whether it was their occupation, their abilities or disabilities or their curses or whatever it is that they're carrying. There is that sense of transparency in that Jesus kind of sees through all the BS layers that society had put on people. And we get that a lot. And I think that's really, it's really good news that we...
Actually, it is incredibly freeing for those who actually practice that to just be able to say, I don't have anything to hide. I don't... Yo. And that's not saying I'm perfect. It's saying I just don't have anything to hide. Mm-hmm. You know, here's my faults. Here's my shortcomings. Here's, oh, I am lousy at, mm-hmm. you know, that. And you put it out there and everybody's like, oh, okay, I can identify with that. And, you know.
Are you good to me too?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You too.
Yeah.
Yeah. You get the stories that you can enter into with someone else. And I think that's part of what we get in Luke that is really beautiful, is that entering into people's stories and getting to find ourselves in the story in ways that we might not find ourselves in other places. It's really hard to find myself in the book of Revelation.
Yeah.
I mean, except for when I was a little kid and really terrified of being raptured, but that's a whole other time.
I keep making movies about it.
I know, right? But anyway, bringing it back.
Bad movies on bad theology.
Yes.
Okay.
We need more Luke movies.
Yes, we do need more Luke movies.
I like this is probably going to be my Bible quote for today.
Okay, go ahead.
Nothing has been covered that will not be exposed. Whatever is secret will be made known.
Mm.
It's almost poetic.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost poetic. It's like, you know, like I dare the candidates to put that on a thing, like, you know.
Yeah.
That's my quote, you know.
Well, there's something like terrifying about it too, in a way, to say that we love and worship a God that sees us exactly how we are. I mean, that's some radical honesty, and that's some radical seeing that Jesus is doing it in this scripture, but living into faith even to this day is letting ourselves be radically seen by God, but also by the community. I was talking to somebody about vulnerability earlier today and how to cultivate an atmosphere of vulnerability and how hard that is. You know, you have to let people give people space to be seen. And I think this is one of the things we get in the scripture, is that people are really seen. Their needs are seen. Who they are is seen. And it's really lovely, but it's really hard. Really, really difficult. So we're going to keep going in Luke. We keep going. Chapter 13. Good stuff. Good stuff. Good stuff. It's all good. Read the book of Luke. I could just stand up here and read all of it to you, but I'm not going to, because I don't have that much of a voice. So we're going to fast forward a whole bunch. Fast forward. Fast forward. Fast forward all the way to chapter 20. There's a lot of good stuff that happened between chapter 10 and 20. Read it on your own and then come back and tell me what stood out most to you. That's your challenge for today or whenever you're listening to it. So chapter 20. This is kind of one of those days, one of those times where Jesus is doing what Jesus does and stuff gets real. He gets called out. One day, as he was teaching the people in the temple and telling the good news, the chief priests and the scribes came with the elders and said to him, "Tell us, by what authority are you doing these things? Who is it that gave you the authority?" He asked them, "I will also ask you a question, and you tell me, did the baptism of John come from heaven, or was it of human origin?" And they discussed it among themselves, and they said, "From heaven." And they said, "If we say from heaven, he will say, 'Did you not believe him?' But if we say of human origin, all the people will stone us, for they are convinced that John was a prophet." So they answered that they did not know where it came from. Then Jesus said to them, neither will I tell you by what authority am I doing these things. Mm. Stuff is getting real. We don't have that many more chapters in the book of Luke, and we already heard the ending of it. Stuff's getting real, real quick. Why do you think that Jesus wasn't making a strong stand here? Why was he not saying whatever? Why did he answer that way? What do you think?
Well, they probably had an air of, we already know, we're just asking you. Mm-hmm. And they probably, I mean, a good teacher leads you to the answer but doesn't give you the answer. Mm-hmm. Which kind of, I think he was kind of having them question what they actually believe and what they actually just followed. And I think that's a lot, because I don't think the a lot of those Pharisees were bad per se. Mm-hmm. I think they were just raised in a way where the law was the most important thing, where they got away from God and they were just so busy in the law. And he was like, well, you know, isn't there a verse where it says something about the law? If you follow the law, anyway. So I think that's what it was really about. He was, because he wasn't going to be there long. He wasn't going to be with them long. So he had to see what, had to have them start questioning all these laws that they were following. Because after the Ten Commandments, they continued to write laws. Mm-hmm. And he was referring to a lot of those man-made laws that they were following that weren't given by Moses.
Well, a quick note, they were. I mean, the 613, that is all part of, but that's God given. Trust me on that one. I think they were trying to lay a trap, mm-hmm. the blasphemy yeah. trap, mm-hmm. you know. And had he answered, you know, honestly and transparently, you know, that would have been grounds for, you know, taking him out right then and there. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what they were playing at, and he.
I think he was trying to get them to think, because they couldn't kill him. He allowed them.
If he had said, "I get my authority from heaven. I am, and equated himself with God right then and there," that would have been justification for them to call for his execution.
Yeah, but they tried to do that before, went off the ledge, and he right. just walked right through the crowd. He's walked right. through the crowd many a time.
Right, but again, this is yet another time. That's what they're doing. They're not just
right.
asking for asking's sake. They were laying a trap.
But I think he's answering it in that way to inspire them to think. Because he's a teacher. And they're not.
But it's a political thing happening there.
It's a political thing, but he's not a political person.
Yes, he is.
He's very at this point,
very much so.
I think he's past his actual where politics and all that matters. I think he's actually saying that, because this starts off in his ministry, in his message. What is he? What is the whole purpose of him talking to them?
But he's challenging the authority structure, and that's what's happening here. They are feeling threatened. They're trying to trap him and take him out.
But he's not feeling threatened.
He knows what they're doing.
Yeah, but he's...
Which is why he doesn't answer the question.
I think he answers... Yeah, I think, well, that's my take on it. I think he inspires the thought, because we're having this discussion hundreds of years later. We're still discussing it. And if he would have gave a rock-solid answer, we would have made that the law.
Okay.
Good discussion. And that's what thinking, I'm drinking water, is all about. It's about bringing all the stuff that we carry to Bible study and to engage in our minds and our hearts, and sometimes some lively interaction. And then when it gets too lively, we bring it back. We'd be like introvert Jesus and go hide in a corner for a minute.
But I think how Jesus answered him was, Jesus knew they were trying to trap him. So Jesus answered them with a question that ultimately would trap the Pharisees who questioned him. So he's, you know, going back, but, you know, he's like, well, I'm going to answer you with a question that puts you in the same position that you put me in, and we're going to walk away. So I think he kind of did that same thing to them, like, Here you go. Ball's back in your court now. What are you going to do? Mm.
So, kind of thinking about the discussion that was just going on, I'm wondering, how is it... I'm thinking a lot about who we view as good and bad in the story, and how easy it is to say Pharisees, bad, 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 other people, good, 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 and how sort of messy that is, but how different it might would have been if we were actually living at the time. And it wasn't like, when you're living at the time, the Pharisees, like, that wasn't the bad people. That was the people you could trust with the religious stories of the society. So how, if we shift our mindset a little bit, that would change.
And I will say that in looking at the time, you had four major groupings there, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Zealots, and I forget what the fourth one was, but I would probably self-identify most readily with the Pharisees.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's just, I could see, yeah, I see where they're coming from. I saw, you know, from a larger standpoint of just the life of Jesus, this group of people that predated the birth of Jesus and were still around after Jesus died and rose again, and what they stood for, they were trying to figure it out and trying to navigate this Jewish life under Roman rule, and I can appreciate what they were trying to do overall.
Right, and you know, you just think back to the history and how much chaos was in the story of the people who had a life of faith, and then we get to the book of Leviticus, the book of Leviticus, and all these rules and laws, and then trying to, even then, things shifted and changed, and how to live into that. I have a hard time seeing them as all the really evil bad guys in my knowledge of that, but then it's also really easy in a book like this where we see the people that Jesus hung out with and the way that he sort of challenged them or was countercultural or political, or however you want to see it. And in that way, you're like, oh, well, Jesus was being kind of Jesus-y to them. Then they may or may not have been good people. So it's that struggle. As a rule follower, I'm like, yeah, I like the people who keep the rules because I want to know what I'm supposed to be doing and whether I'm doing it or not. And Jesus kind of burst that wide open and says, these are the people I'm going to spend time with. These are the things that I'm going to do. I'm going to heal on the Sabbath. I'm going to heal these people that are complicated stories and messy stories. I'm going to spend time with women in a way that culture says, maybe don't do that. I'm going to teach the disciples how to pray with prayers that are different than what they've been taught before. I'm going to take, in chapter 22, I'm going to take this festival of unleavened bread, Passover, and turn it into something completely new and different. And that was something that have very specific instructions. Like, this is how you do Passover. I mean, even to this day, Passover is a thing. And you do this and this and this and this and this. And yet, Jesus does something different here. And tells the story differently and lives into it differently. And shifts and changes. And there's some discussion about whether what happens in communion is a shift or change from Passover or something completely new or different, or what really happens there. But what we do know is that in that moment, Jesus was living into a tradition that was already existing. He was living into the rules that probably some of those people that people say, oh, they were against Jesus, were helping to enforce and helping them, not even just to enforce, but to teach people. They were the, you know, some of these people that would say, oh, they hated Jesus. No, that was how people got religious instruction, and sometimes, you know, people weren't getting it right.
Wow, that's really...
Yeah. What are you thinking?
The Passover was when they took the blood and put it over the doors, right? So that death wouldn't kill the firstborn, but it killed the firstborn. Jesus was literally the firstborn, and he died. Mm-hmm. And Passover being tied to communion and him dying as a sacrifice for our sins, almost like the firstborn of the Egyptians being killed as a sacrifice to free the Jews. Okay, I'm done.
Well, and to tie into what you just shared, the blood that they put on their door had to be of a lamb with all these things, blemish-free, this-free, this-free. It had to be the perfect lamb. So you just couldn't go out back and be like, ah, you get that little scrawny one. We're going to use his. You had to find the perfect lamb to sacrifice, to put the blood over your door in order for the death angel to pass. So how you tied it in is perfect because Jesus was that perfect lamb that could be the blood sacrifice. So now all of us are, like when they say covered by his blood, we literally are covered by his blood. And Passover ties that all together in the so importance of having that perfect lamb sacrifice where Jesus couldn't answer them and say, I am from God, I'm his son, because then he wouldn't have been the perfect sacrifice, because then he would have had to been killed because he committed blasphemy and all this other stuff. So it's really cool how you tie that in, and it all connects together, mm-hmm. and why that Passover Jesus had to do differently, because he now is the sacrifice.
The pain of the whole world.
Yeah. And there's, you know, there's a lot of conversations that happen about Passover and communion and how does it all fit together. And there are people who believe and think all sorts of different things. But the one piece that I hear through a lot of the different discussions is that idea of some kind of physical body being involved. This is not a, in our heads, all of a sudden something changes. Whether it's the Passover meal, whether it's the story of the Passover, in the Old Testament, or sort of the story in Luke 22 about the thing that turns into communion, the Last Supper, there is a physical element to it. There is something about blood, something about sacrifice. There is something about someone having to make a costly choice. Mm. Now, the costly choice are different throughout the stories, but a choice has to be made. The easy way is not what you get to choose at this moment. You're talking about finding the lamb that was unblemished. Well, yeah, it was hard. And that's kind of, even if we can't agree on any of these other pieces, it's a difficult story. It is a hard story. It's a liberating story because as Christians, as people of faith, when we come to the communion table, we get to be part of that story, even if we ourselves aren't perfect, because y'all were not. Even if we are the outcast, even if we are like Judas, who's going to betray him real quick. Even if we're like the disciples that literally the next paragraph, they're like, well, who's the greatest? I'm the greatest. You know, like, even though we are like that, we get to come to the table and participate in that costly story and be invited to that grace and be invited into that story that has all these arms and fingers and hands and tentacles and whatever it is stretching back to all these different things. And there's something really, it's giving me chills. I don't know about y'all, but I'm like real into it.
Perfect at the table.
That's
the one thing I love about this now, especially with the 505 and Riverside. It's like we do the open table mm-hmm. communion, which means so much, because I had heard that, you know, you had to be perfect, you had to do all this, you got to fit into this little whatever. And the open table, as actually shown in scripture, is the open table was for everyone that was there, like not just the rich, not just the powerful, not just the law abiding. It was for everybody. And that's really the grace that you talk. Like, I get excited about that too, because it's like, it's not a past tense, it's a current tense, you know, which, hey, can I coin that phrase? No, I kind of like that, current tense. Anyway.
Well, and, you know, kind of fast forwarding the story again, I am that person that tells the stories in an order. I don't know if y'all seen that chart online that's like over here and over here and over here. Yeah, I mean, sometimes that's me. But if we fast forward through Easter, through the crucifixion and resurrection, fast forward to chapter 24, there is another time when a meal becomes very, very, very important. And so we are picking up the story, and it's around verses 20-ish, 25, 26, 27, and we're in this part of the story. The disciples are kind of walking, and somebody is joining them, but they don't realize who it is. And so here's where we're picking up on verse 28 of chapter 24 of Luke. As they came near the village to which the disciples were going, he, spoiler alert, Jesus, walked ahead as if he was going on, but they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, because it is almost evening, and the day is now nearly over." So he went in to stay with them, and when he was at the table with them, he took bread and blessed it and broke it and gave it to them. And then their eyes were open and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. At that table, in that moment, in that breaking of the bread, Jesus was fully seen by the disciples, and he already fully saw them. It was only in that moment where they realized that this was the person that they had been longing for, hoping for, praying for, because they had just seen this really terrible, awful thing, and then this wonderful thing, and then something in between, and like, what's going to happen now? And so there are these table moments where the story shifts and changes. And to me, that story is almost one of those moments where you stop and pause and say, this story doesn't make any other sense in real life. Because if I'm sitting with someone that I know, even if I haven't seen them in a long time, I'm going to know eventually. But it took the breaking of the bread, the buying into that story, the living into it, those words that are repeated for the disciples to see that. And I think there's something there. That's one of those miraculous, amazing stories that aren't the big miracles, but we had the transfiguration over here. We have Jesus, you know, beam me up, Jesus, over here. But then there are these everyday, ordinary moments where we get to recognize how God is moving within us, just like how the disciples saw Jesus in the breaking of the bread.
Mic drop.
Yeah. And so that takes us to the end of Luke. There's a whole bunch of stuff that we skipped because there is a whole bunch of stuff in here. I'm wondering, what sort of thoughts, what sort of questions, what sort of takeaways do y'all have?
So the part of me that appreciates writing and researching, mm-hmm. I can't get that opening out of my head of just, you know, Luke saying, I've gone over a whole bunch of other stuff, checked a whole bunch of source material, and then everything after that was thinking, so was it Mary or Martha that told him about that story? Mm. You know, was it, you know, who, you know, where did these different things, you know, whose version was he getting along the way kind of thing? Now, and you know, as we discussed last week, most scholars would agree that, you know, there is a lot that he probably took from Mark, you know, as did Matthew. And then there's yeah, it's interesting the similarities between these three Gospels. But yeah, it sounds like he did some extra research and looked around. I would have loved to have been part of that research team.
Exactly. I definitely got a different feeling for Luke now. It's, you know what he reminds me of? He reminds me of a Sherlock Holmes and a Columbo. And maybe, I don't know, but he just reminds, because the whole, like he was saying, Ken, about the research. And he's, like, actually referring back to other things. Like, this isn't just, like, he wasn't a person that was caught in a lot of emotion. He was a person that was very steadfast, very focused, very, you know, and here are the facts, you know, just the facts. He's dragnet on this thing. He's like, here are the facts, you know, and he has nothing, I mean, of all the different people that have stories in the Bible, he doesn't have anything to gain or lose by this story. He's not, like, as a Jewish person, yeah, you know, you're always prophesized about it. But as a Gentile, he's got nothing. He's already on the outside. He really doesn't refer to being Greek, so he knows he's not part of that hierarchy. He's not Jewish, so he's not part of that. But he's telling these stories in such an honest and just straightforward way that, you know, I appreciate his looking into the story, you know. And there's just one more thing, you know? So, yeah, he's the detective. I think, I instead of calling him Dr. Luke, I'm going to call him Detective Luke from now on.
I think I got just a better understanding of some of the different like having these discussions like really makes that Martha Mary, you know, thing. You look at it so many different ways because, you know, and you think about it, if you were Martha and someone else was Mary, like each of you would have saw Jesus' arrival in a different light. Just like, I can understand the sisters going back and forth. I have a sister. Whereas, you know, Damon, who doesn't have siblings, maybe you can't understand it the same way. And then also from a man's perspective, a different view. So we all see it differently. But when we get to sit together and say, well, this is what I got, and this is what I got, and this is what I got, you're like, wow, you just get such a bigger picture and a better understanding of all these things that were written and how they're written so long ago, but today they're so significant and how they can continue to help us on our journey, you know, in discovering life, how to do life better, and how to understand these gospels better. And just how, you know, Luke, like when he wrote this, they said he wrote it to Theophilus. I'm probably saying it wrong. I'm not Greek. But that name means the one who loves Jesus. So it doesn't, you don't even know if he's writing it to like a person like, I'm writing this to my friend Emma, or I'm writing this to people who love Jesus. Like it could just be a letter.
Right.
Hey, any of y'all out there who love Jesus, let me tell you, this is who I'm writing it to, which is like, wow, I never knew that. So that just kind of brought a whole other light, and how he just kind of wrote it like, this is a story and these are the facts, and he kept it in an order that made sense and it flowed. It maybe not happened in chronological order, but in an order that flowed and made sense, keeps you captivated, keeps you like, oh, and he put this here, and very methodical, you know, probably like a doctor would think, very methodical. You know, first you have to do this and then do that to get to that. So it's kind of like it was written in decency and order. I almost think of it like that. So it's kind of what I got out of it.
I think one of the things that I got out of really kind of digging into Luke is the importance of the ways that the stories are told and what's in there and what's not in there. And then that idea that Ken was talking about transparency and being honest with ourselves about what we're bringing to the text and what we're reading into it or not reading into it, and how that transparency and that vulnerability is part of doing faith and having conversations and having the space to have those little asides of, here's where I'm amazed, here's where I'm troubled, here's where I'm wondered about, because sometimes we can get so hung up in, we're going to plug away at the Bible and just trying to get through it that we don't give ourselves space to say, I have a problem with this, and here is why. Does anyone else? And I feel a little selfish about bringing that up, but then also that's part of what we're doing here at Think and Drink is bringing ourselves to the table. And Alan brings all these different pieces, but then we also talk about it. So it's not just the super academic. It's the head and the heart and the struggles and the wonders and being okay in that space. So y'all should come Think and Drink. Bull Bay Cuisine, 5:05 p.m. on Wednesdays. Yeah. So it's a good time.
Yes. Yes. Great time.
Yeah.
And a quick round for Emma.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Riverfront Church Podcast. You can connect with us online at Riverfront Wilmo, that's Riverfront WILMO.com, or on Facebook. Just search for Riverfront Church in Wilmington, Delaware. May God meet you where you are and lead you where you are meant to go.